So we were talking about, we just cut in to talk a little about your going from a one-room schoolhouse to 40 children in a class. And what was that like for you?
Scary. It was really overwhelming when I look back. I didn't like it. I was very unhappy for quite a while. I didn't want to leave the farm in the first place. I mean, you leave all the animals, your horse that you rode all the time, and all the great things about a farm, and you leave, you go to the city. And then, of course, there are all those city kids who are making fun of the hicks from the farm.
How old were you?
11.
They all had bicycles where you'd had a horse, right? Some of them had bicycles.
Not all of them.
Okay.
So I finished up, that was the Eastwood School, and then I finished there and started grade 9, which was high school those days, at Eastwood. And I went there for 2 years, 9 and 10, and then talked my parents into letting me go to commercial high school to switch, because I wanted to take commercial courses.
You knew you weren't going to go to the university, so you thought
you
might as well get business.
I didn't want to be a teacher. I didn't want to be a nurse. My father really wanted me to be a nurse. I had no desire to be a nurse at that time, and I certainly didn't want to teach. And I wanted to be, you know, get secretarial skills, which I did. And I went to commercial high school and graduated from there. So, and we had the Olympic girls basketball team. Came from Edmonton, the Edmonton grads, and they played all over the United States because girls' basketball was very, very much in those years. And I wanted to play, and I did play on the team, but they made so much fun of my long legs, and we wore short shorts, that I quit playing.
Was this the other girls made fun, or the
no,
boys?
No, the guys, you know, would be whistling and calling me snake hips and all these remarks, and I just hated it, and so I quit playing basketball.
Was your father encouraging you to play?
Of course. He thought I was stupid when I quit. So.
You enjoyed it, it was just the other part of it.
I didn't like, you know, everybody looking at me and making fun of me.
And did they travel? They used to travel some too.
Oh yeah, they went all over. Went all over the United States and everything. And as I said, I don't know where they did the Olympics.
Oh,
1936, I think.
I think that was the last one. Didn't they get canceled for the war then?
They canceled out 40.
Yeah.
40, they canceled out.
Yeah.
So did you travel with them at all out of Edmonton?
No. I just played on the school team, you know,
right
there. But they also...
That was the feeder. Those
right,
were the feeder team.
Right. And the principal of the school was the coach of the basketball team.
So he was encouraging you.
Yeah.
Were you tall, considered tall?
I was 5'6", mm-hmm, which was, you know, quite tall in those days, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I was all arms and legs, you know.
Right.
Didn't like the comments.
So then when you went to... Going back, you'd live by yourself, and then Gwen came and joined you when you were working
in
Edmonton.
Right. When I was finished up at the hospital, I went to work on the south side at the Treasury Department in the bank. And my mother and father then went up to Lesser Slave Lake. My father got a job on the highways. And what they call him, the superintendent of the highways at that point.
Yeah.
And big fancy name. All the roads were gravel, and he had a grader, and he went up and down the roads, keeping them in shape all the time. And
but it was pretty good pay for that time.
Yeah, well, yeah, by then it was. And he, Gwen and June went with them first, and then Gwen had to finish high school. So she came and lived with me.
When was the time you told me that it was really tough where you'd get some money together and then you'd buy back the beds you sold?
That was when we lived in Edmonton when I was growing up.
So that was during the Depression?
very much so after we first moved in there. We actually moved into Edmonton because our farm had gone under. 3 years in a row, we were hailed out. And it was time for Dee Dee to go on to high school. And it meant either, because she went into grade 9 when we went in, and it meant she would have to go to Clyde and board with somebody, or go to Edmonton and board with somebody. And my father decided that he'd get a job in Edmonton, we'd go to Edmonton, and she'd go to high school.
And at least she wouldn't have to board then, too.
Right, right. And she was with the family, right. And that's why we moved to Edmonton, originally. And my father had different jobs in Edmonton.
And that was pretty common to everyone at that time, from what I can read. Everybody was moving around.
It was terrible. I mean, jobs were scarce. That's when men were really selling apples on the street corners. Yeah. I remember that.
All the way up there. I know in big cities down here they were, but up there
too. They were doing the same thing there. And they were riding the freight trains, and, you know, it wasn't surprising at all to see somebody at your back door asking for a sandwich or a cup of soup or something. And they moved from here to there just trying to get, trying to live.
It wasn't considered sort of disrespect. No. Respectable at that time. It was just, what could you do? Or at least they were moving around trying to get work.
Right. And they'd come and say, can I chop wood for the day and for a meal and all that. And, it was tough. Those were very tough times. People are more familiar with it in the United States, but it was the same in Canada. It's exactly the same.
Basically, people were moving around. They were doing anything. They'd put all their belongings from the farm on the car or whatever and move to next town and try to get something.
We also lived on what you call here welfare. We called it relief there. But the men worked for it. You know, they'd give them city jobs, going around picking up garbage and junk, you know. And they'd work so many days for that, and then they'd get... I don't know what they call it, certificates or what, for clothes and for, you know, money for the family. They'd get vouchers, they would probably call, that they would get. So my father worked at jobs like that and paid off.
But there were also jobs where they went around, since they didn't have, like, running sewage from the outhouses, did they have to go and clean them out from time to time?
To go and pick
the honey
up.
Wagon.
That's right. They had to go pick that up.
Did they have honey wagons down here too?
Not to my knowledge, no. Mm-hmm. We always had indoor plumbing.
Always? From the time we got off the boat. From the time we came over from Ireland?
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean my father and my
mother. Oh, you mean your family?
Yeah, the family. Oh, no, they probably had them in different parts of the States.
Right.
They just didn't have them in Brooklyn where we were growing up.
But you knew about the honey wagons. You heard her stories.
Well, we
didn't call them honey wagons up there, though. No. But they had lots of funny stories about it. But the outhouses were built for the
so the trap door would come up in the back?
Right. It was a trap door that.
Oh, sure. Where did when I went with her and met members of her family before we got married, they had the back houses right there.
Yeah,
there.
Still there.
This is in the city of Edmonton.
Right.
And of course, up on Lesser Save Lake, they had the same thing. Now, why don't you tell them about dancing and so forth up there in White Horse?
We haven't got there yet.
Well, before, you got as far as going to White Horse, and he wanted to skip.
No, I wanted to go back.
Oh, okay.
He was going on. He wanted to know about the first day that we met.
Right.
That's what you're waiting for, right?
Yeah. But before that, she was in White Horse for about 6 months before it dark. So the people up there availed themselves of an opportunity to go partying and to go dancing, right? Juan, you take it
away. And on picnics.
And picnics.
And up to Lake Klamani.
There's like picnics in the middle of the night?
Yeah, you'd work until 10 or 12 o'clock at night sometimes, you know, overtime, and then you'd have a picnic lunch with you. And I was very good friends with the baker, and tell him what we wanted, and we'd pack up picnic lunch and go up to Lake Lewanee sometimes or somewhere else.
So it's like 10 miles away or something?
No, something 50, 60 miles away.
So and you go by horse or did you
have a car? No. That's when we had jeeps and the command cars and things, you know.
Oh,
we
from
was,
the
that
place?
That was in Whitehorse, right.
Oh, so they were company cars.
Yeah.
And army jeeps.
And army jeeps and everything. No, I had quite a summer. Because it just never got dark, so
you'd get home at 3 o'clock in the morning, you have to be up.
Yeah, I mean, you get real tired, but then you get your second wind, and you know, it was like, okay, well, I was young too. You could go.
How old were you there?
21.
21.
Mm-hmm. By the time I got there in October, it was getting dark most of the time and getting a little bit on the chilly side, you know, so her forays into the dancing fields. And the evening were ended by then.
No, they weren't. I still went to the dances. Huh? I still went to the dances.
Oh, yeah, but it was dark.
You
know,
yeah,
it got
dark
at 5 and 6 o'clock.
Right. Yeah, that was a bad part of the winter because it was dark most of the time then. Summer was great. But in the winter, we went to work in the dark. And
it got light at 10 o'clock, and it got dark again at 3 in the afternoon.
It's like when I was in Copenhagen.
Yeah, that'd be about the same thing.
Yeah. Well, this is even more extreme because you're a little further north, I think. Yeah. So when you were there, you saw a number of people coming in their files who was coming, so you knew this Mr. Keith was coming and that he had been involved in things in South America. And
right. And I also knew he wasn't married. Because that's what I learned to look up for. Because, you know, a lot of the guys came up there and they pretended they weren't married or tried to get away with the fact they were married. So, but he came into the office, I tell you, at 10 o'clock
that
morning. Because you had already gone to the personnel and got things straightened out there.
We rode all night over the White Pass in Yukon. Then we got in about 6 o'clock in the morning into Whitehorse.
And you came into the payroll office about, then I remember you standing at the counter, and he had a striped, gray-striped suit on. Did you have the Homburg?
The Homburg.
you expected to come in twirling a cane, you know? And I looked up and I, oh my God.
So you knew who it was immediately?
Well, pretty immediately.
You must have been pretty tan, too, if you just been in South America.
Oh, he was real dark. His hair was, you know, real dark then, too, and he was so tan. And I thought, oh, boy, tall, dark and handsome. But then the winter came, you know, and I found out.
You lose the tan.
Right.
And I looked over there, and I saw her in the files, and I said, oh, ho, look at Blondie.
he must have been impressed because we went over to Kathy Wetland then was working in the personnel.
Right.
And he had checked in with her. I guess they assigned you and then you went and got your clothes. You were assigned
you had
to get
clothes. All my winter
gear. And your blankets for your bed and all that. And we used to go for lunch at the big Quonset hut that was a mess hall. And we'd wait outside till they opened the doors. And I'm talking to Kathy and a group of other people. And he's with two or three other guys over at the side. And the next thing I hear him going, oh, Kathy! Kathy! You know, like Heathcliff. And all the time he's doing that, he's looking straight at me. So he comes over and then Kathy has to introduce him to me.
Yeah, we
know.
Were formally introduced. And she used to call me Mr. Keith. Right.
Kathy did too, or just Mom?
No. But that he wasn't the only one. I called everybody Mr. And then he came back and they assigned him. My file cabinets were set up, three of them, tall file cabinets, and there was about this much space in between each one. And they put his desk, because they were trying to organize everybody. I mean, people would come in three or four at a time. They put his desk right there behind my file cabinet. So every time I'd go to do my filing, there'd be this eye looking at me through this. And I think it was that night that I was doing the work on the
bonds.
On the bonds, because we sold bonds as well
to the workers.
Yeah, yeah.
So they could save their money.
Yeah, we take the money out of the payroll, and then, you know.
And so I was working on the books doing that, and there was a young soldier I knew, and he had come over. And he said he'd help me. And he had wanted me to go, I guess, to one of the dances. And I said, no, I couldn't, you know, I had to do this. Well, I'll stay and help you. So he comes over, and he says, I'll help too. I'll help you too. So then pretty soon he says to the, I don't even remember the guy's name. I can't even remember.
You're a soldier.
He says to him, that's all right, we don't need you anymore. We'll finish up. He tells him to leave.
Were you shocked when you did that?
Of course I was. I mean, what do you say? The guy was very nice. He was trying to help, but right. He wanted me to go out with him. So then I think you asked me then to go out that Saturday night with you to...
USED.
To Whitehorse, the town. Because you were meeting some of your friends.
Yeah, there were a lot of people with the United States Engineering Department that I had worked with in Trinidad.
Mm-hmm.
And after they left Trinidad, they went up to the Yukon. So I saw them again, and we renewed our friendship. As a matter of fact, one of the guys I roomed with in Trinidad, Jules McCable, he was up there, so we got together again. And Wanda became a very close friend of his after a while, you know, and his wife and so forth.
They're the ones that we stopped with when we went to Canada in 1960.
You know, Michael was a little fella.
1965, when we first went.
So he was.
And then in 1970, 69 and 70. You went up with me in 69, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, did we stop in Wisconsin?
Stopped a few places, I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, well, I think so. But anyway, on the way back, we definitely stopped and stayed overnight with Jules and his wife, Helen, in Wisconsin.
So you made some friendships that lasted
very,
quite a while.
Very.
Was it part of it was because there was such close living arrangements too? And
no, I don't think that. It's just you worked nice people work from with. All over. Yeah. You know, I found.
So both Canadians and Americans were on the staff.
Oh yeah.
They all lived in the same barracks.
Mm-hmm.
They had the Canadians and the Americans in the same barracks. And the women's barracks was about 100 yards from the men's barrack, right?
Right.
And then you had the men's barrack, the women's barrack, then you had the office, and then next to that you had the mess hall.
And other buildings.
What about the showers? They were all separate, weren't they?
The showers.
Not in the women's.
The women had the
showers? The women had their own showers, but the men, the showers is about a quarter of a mile from there, you know, where we used to go.
And you had the washing machines down there that you could do your clothes and everything too. And we had ours right in our headquarters.
Did you guys, were you guys all in one room or you had separate rooms for the women too?
Well, some of them shared, there were four of them in a room, but I got...
You had four in the women's?
Yeah, down at the other end of the
I only do two. What was her name? Nancy Furman and...
And Helen Ashford. They had two. Right, but there was a couple...
Before,
yes,
right?
Yeah. But my room... See, I was one of the first girls to go up there, one of the first six. And so I had a choice. They very kindly gave... First, they kept me in the hotel down in Whitehorse and picked me up every day and brought me to the office. Took me back at night. And when they got the Quonset hut set up as headquarters, they had single rooms at the front. There's a community room where the big stove was to keep the fire going and everything warm. And there was three single rooms on each side going down the hallway. And I picked the first one. And that's where I had the whole time, so I had my privacy in my own room. So there was
men's barracks, you just had a bed. Period.
Everybody was in the same.
Everybody, you have 40 guys, and
40 guys, not even four to a room or anything. It was
just 40 beds, and you had heated
just
with heated with the round belly stove. You had three round belly stoves, one at this end, one in the middle, and one at that end. And then the bull cook used to come through all during the night and throw wood on to keep it warm, you know. And the son of a gun, he'd get drunk every now and then, he wouldn't show up. He'd get up in the morning, it would be freezing. And and at the other end of the barracks where I had my bed, they also had hot water, which the water was in a big can, you know, and they heated it. You'd go up there, get a little water, and you'd shave. And the John was about 50 yards away from there. And if you had to get up during the middle of the night or anything like that, you had to walk 50 yards, through the cold and the ice to get there.
Was that same with the woman's thing, or that they had the John inside
her? Everything indoors.
Was indoor plumbing or a latrine?
They lived high on a hog. They had it right in there, you know.
We were treated very nicely.
And the food was just great.
Wonderful.
After being in South America for 2 years, you know, in the tropics, the food there was not in the same with the food up in the Yukon. It was really great food. And also, you had wonderful bakers, so it was good. But the thing that amazes me, we used to go down the highway every week to pay off. And it was a distance of roughly 200 miles from Camp McRae, where we were, to Watson Lake. And every 50 miles or so, they had what they call a repeater station. And that repeater station, they had about a sergeant and 10 men. Now they all get the same food, and yet some of those repeater stations you would never go back to eat with them again because the food and the coffee was so lousy. But the other place which got the same food, and they had a good cook, you know, who made sure the guys were treated right, you'd make sure you'd eat at their place when you went down the highway.
Yeah, it made all the difference in the world having a good cook, bull cook, and a good baker.
Oh, what a difference.
We were fortunate.
Because those were one of the few sort of things you had to look forward to was a good meal.
Oh, yeah.
People would relax and sort of like the merchant ship.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Now you can understand why I agreed to marry him and come down on our honeymoon if we'd go back to Alaska.
You wanted to get the good food?
Yeah, and I wanted to, you know, stay up there.
And you didn't have any intention of having children right away, then, I assume.
Whatever God said.
Right, but you hadn't thought it through. Yeah.
No. No, we were supposed to go back. We were all ready to go back to Alaska.
Tell them about the cabin.
What cabin?
The cabin on the river.
Oh. I got that before you came up there.
Yeah, I know.
A couple of my friends and I found this cabin that had been, it was a trapper's cabin that had been abandoned. Because when they, you know, when you left there, you didn't take things with you. Mm-hmm. There was really no way to take it out of there. It wasn't worthwhile. So it had tables and benches and chairs in it and a stove and all of that. But it hadn't been lived in a long time. So we got equipment and cleaned it all up. And we used to go down there and cook meals. You know, a whole bunch of us would go down.
Just for the weekend type of thing?
Or? No, just for the night, for the evening. You know, we'd get stuff from the
commissary.
Yeah. It was 2 miles from our camp. We used to walk.
And we'd walk down and have a big meal and sit around and talk and everything and just enjoy ourselves. So. And when your father came up, he joined us. And the first night, was it the first night you went down that you fell in the water?
No, it was after a couple of weeks. Yeah.
But then you knew you were getting into it. He just didn't realize how cold it would be or the snow.
Well, he was dressed by then for everything. But we were going down this one night, and everybody helped each other across. There was some streams that the water wasn't frozen the whole way through. And the water was off the river. It was like a small brook off the river. And it never froze that winter the whole way. It was moving so swiftly, I guess.
didn't get enough to freeze.
Yeah, that it
so across
freeze.
The top it would somewhat.
Yeah. Right, yeah, there would be ice and everything.
But it was very thin.
Right.
But there was, we had logs that were, went across it, so we could walk across it. But everybody helped each other. You know, one person would give the other person a hand, and then they'd help across. Your father. I can manage myself. No, I don't need a hand. And of course, you know, he had the brace.
No, but I said, as long as I get my hands on these branches, we've got
my mitts on these branches. That's what you said.
I'll just go right over, you know. What I overlooked was the fact that the branches were going to break. And then I'm in midstream, and all of a sudden it breaks, and boom.
So one leg goes down into the water and everything, and we get down there, and he takes his.
Did you hear some choice words, or was he able to keep
it? Oh, he, I never knew your father used language like that until we were on our way back after our honeymoon.
You mean he went down into the water and he didn't curse?
No.
What did he just say? Oh.
He probably did under
his breath. I was a little concerned because, you know, it's below zero.
We still had a ways to walk.
We had to go. Well, we had about a quarter of a mile to go to the cabin, you know.
So he took his socks off and his shoes. And he put the, it wasn't the brace leg, it wasn't the leg he had the brace on,
no,
it was the other one.
My left leg.
And he put everything up by the fire.
Right.
And then he's talking and telling his jokes and, you know, everybody's like, all of a sudden we go, something's burning.
And it was your shoes?
My socks.
Oh no, so you had no socks then either. Did you get them out of the fire? Or
oh yeah, sure, real quick, but they were a little charred.
On the way back. Now he had further to go back to camp. On the way back, he does the same thing. I say, now come on, Jack, you know, take our hand. No, I'm fine. Down he goes again.
I must admit that on the way back, I was very concerned because it was about a mile and three quarters to go.
Yeah.
And it's now cold. And I'm here, I'm remembering all the stories that they tell in the barracks. We'd sit around and they'd tell stories about guys freezing to death or losing their feet and their hands. And oh.
So you were saying, I'm fine, but you were like, can we go a little faster?
Yeah.
You were leading the charge to get back.
I have to tell you this, too. He was so brave. He always had a hunting knife. We had bears. I mean, big, big brown bears up around the dump. And they hung around the dump. They didn't bother anybody.
No, they would run, you know,
but they were there going through the food. So as long as they were getting enough food, they weren't going to bother us. But he's got this hunting knife, and I'm saying to him, what are you carrying that knife for? You know, why have you got that knife? And he said, just in case the bears come after us. And I said to him, and what would you do, hand me the knife and run? And he said, of course.
And then we were going out pretty much, I guess almost you might say every night, huh? After a while. And then she went home on leave. In December, about December the 7th, and I went out to the plane with her, you know, and I said, I want to ask you something when you come back. She says, no,
I don't want to hear it.
And all I wanted to do was ask her to go to dinner at the White Horse Inn when she came back from vacation.
I knew he wanted to ask me.
Back, she had seen a few of her old chums and so forth, and she kissed her, shall we say, liking for me faded a little bit into the distance. And she said she didn't want to go out with me only on weekends, so then on.
But why did I tell you that?
Why?
Because you did say you wanted to get, you were serious and you really wanted to marry me.
Yeah.
And I said, no way. So then he said, the next time he asked me, he said, but you have to become, you know, I'm Catholic and you have to become Catholic. I said, forget it. Forget it. No way.
But so even though you said no, he still told you you had to become Catholic. He didn't really fully accept no.
So we came back from, when I came back, he had grown a beard. And everybody in the office was saying, teasing him, you know, and saying, oh, Will, when it gets back, you'll have to cut that beard off. He said, I won't have to cut the beard off. Nobody will tell me to cut the beard off. So he's telling me that all the office was saying this to him. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah. So I said, no, I'm not telling you to cut the beard off. But I won't go out with you anymore. So he shaved the beard. But he still left the mustache.
Was that the first time you'd had a beard? Or did you have one?
No, I had one in South America.
Yeah, I have a picture of him on a bicycle with a beard in South America.
I had one when I was up at camp, when I was a camp counselor. I was 20, 21 years of age, you know, when I was still in college.
But how come it was so strange to you when I grew one?
Huh?
How come it was so strange to you when I first grew
one? Down in Trinidad, there was a guy, he was in construction, but he was also a wrestler, and his name was something, I forget his name, he had a beard. And when I had the beard, the little kids down there, the natives would all see me, or they go something, they'd call out the name of the guy.
Oh, the wrestler. The
wrestler, you know, they'd say that. And when I was in Brazil, they said I looked like Errol Flynn. And I had a little mustache, you know, and they go, oh, here comes Errol Flynn. Oh, yeah, I know what it was. His name was Whiskers Blake. And the little kids would see me, they'd say, Whiskers, Whiskers, Whiskers Blake. Whiskers, Whiskers, Whiskers Blake. Yeah.
So you think overall it was a really good experience for you?
Oh, it was a wonderful experience. Yeah.
Were there many people from other countries there, or was it mostly just Americans and Canadians?
Mostly Americans and Canadians. There
That's
weren't,
all.
There
we,
weren't
we,
any.
We had a couple of Eskimos up there.
Oh, yeah.
I had some Eskimos in my barracks. And every night they used to beat the hell out of one another. And we would get in there and we'd separate them, you know. And the next night they'd be out there plugging away. So finally we said, well, let them hell with them. Let them kill one another. You can't stop them.
What was it? They came from different parts? Or they just, would they get drunk, do you think?
I don't know how they got in there, but they probably had something to do with construction. They would.
No, I mean, what do you think what it was why they would start to fight?
It's hard to say. I really don't know because we didn't speak to them too much. You know, didn't know their language.
But the Canadians were all from all over Canada.
I see.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The Americans were all from all over the United States.
Yeah, sure.
But a lot of them were from Kansas City.
From where?
Kansas City.
Oh, yeah, because that's where the job...
Right.
The headquarters for the company?
Right.
The corporate offices were.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot from Minnesota.
Yes.
Awful lot from Minnesota. Yeah.
And New York, too, when you look back.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So it was really typical of many people's war experience in that... A lot of people would move to another part of the country, then a lot of people would come from another part.
Right.
And it'd be all this mixing that seems to have gone on during that period.
Yeah, and of course all the soldiers that were stationed up there, too.
How many soldiers were stationed around there? What were they doing? Were they guarding?
Do we hear something like 20,000 soldiers?
Oh, there must have been at least
that. You see, they had a lot of camps all around there. And they had about 200 women.
Was it mostly Canadian soldiers then? Or?
No,
United States soldiers.
But this is all Canadian territory. Were they supposed to be guarding the road? It was start to be,
well,
it was supposed to be like a national supply route.
They were working together. There were Canadian soldiers too, but not Canadian soldiers to the extent that were American soldiers.
There were a lot more American soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
Were they lightly armed or how were they?
They were trained as well. They were training as well.
They were engineers. And then they were, I guess, maybe some infantrymen, because the thought was there's always a possibility that the Japanese may come through, and you had to stop them. Of course, they never got closer than Adak, which was thousands of miles from where we were.
Yeah, but the Russian subs were right there.
Oh, the Russian subs were there. And,
and even though Russia was...
Well, the Russians were up there, too, because we were... Whitehorse was one of the places where they would... ship planes to Russia. They come to Whitehorse, to Fairbanks, and then I suppose they jump over. But I've seen the Russians up there.
Would there be Russians across in your camps? Or
No.
Passing through?
No, I really, there'd just be a couple, and maybe they just coming for a plane, you know.
And they'd come and pick up the planes and fly them across.
Yes, yeah.
See, so the Americans were...
The big airport was there in Whitehorse.
In Whitehorse. Not too far from where you were.
You would have...
So the Americans would fly the planes there.
Right.
Then they'd fly over a bunch of Russian pilots, pick up the planes and fly them across?
I think they have the pilots maybe in Fairbanks, Alaska, and then they'd fly them over, you know. But I can remember the planes coming through in Whitehorse, and I happened to be at the airfield a couple of times. And you know, they'd have to check them out and everything once they landed. I can still see the mechanics there, the Army mechanics, you know, going out there, taking their gloves off, go boom, 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 but so cold, they put their gloves on again, they run back and get warm.
Well, they also had those big, like, you probably saw pictures of them in the Depression, when they'd have them out on the streets with their homeless people.
Right.
Like the big 50-gallon drums.
Right.
And they'd make, and they'd make the fires.
So they'd go and get their hands warm because they had to use their hands.
Right. Well, when I was in the hospital up there, and the pipes went that night.
Oh, when I came
underneath the hospital, one of the pipes broke, of the water pipes. And they had those, it was so cold, and they were out there. I felt so sorry for them, because you could only stay out for like about 10 minutes working on the stuff. And then
they had to dig down through all of the dirt, you know, which was frozen,
a lot of it.
And then they had to get to the pipes and get to the leak. And I was in there talking to some of my friends. And I thought to myself, geez, I'm glad I'm not a pilot, not a plumber tonight. And they had to go on there, you know, and do what they could.
When I look back over my life and look at the different sections of it, it would be hard to say what was the most interesting. And yet it was so diverse. It was, you know, so different.
It must have been quite a shock if you thought that's what you're going back to. For like, you're very happy there, you knew what it was about, you just gotten married, you're going to go back together, and then all of a sudden that didn't happen, and it was another whole thing that you hadn't expected.
Not only that, he had to get a job before he could keep me here.
Oh, so it looked like you might be split up.
Oh, yeah. I had a month's visitor's permit, right?
Yeah, that's one month.
And even though he was your wife?
Even though we were married, that's all right.
Oh, because
he... when he decided we weren't going back to Alaska, he had to find a job here, then I had to go back up to Canada. To Montreal.
Get a permanent entry.
To get a visa to come in.
Oh, because you'd come in as temporary.
Yeah.
If you had originally knew you were, it probably would have been okay, right?
Right, but we didn't, you know, plan on staying here.
So did you go all the way back to Edmonton, or you just went over the border?
To Montreal.
Montreal, and when she came back, my mother said to her, she said, you know, it was just a lot of foreigners in me.
I didn't say that. I was disgusted with the way they treated
the other people.
Because there were a lot of Russians coming into the country and a lot of other people coming through. And they treated me very nicely.
Because you were Canadian.
I spoke English. I was Canadian.
You're married to an American.
But they treated, you know, some of those people that couldn't speak English, you know, that were coming across. And they were, you know, like, they really treated them like cattle. I was telling Mom about how disgusted I was, and she said, terrible the way they treated the foreigners.
Yeah.
Right? And his mother started to laugh. She said, what do you think you are? And I said, you know, you're right. I never thought of that.
So, they were coming through Canada to come into the U.S.?
Yes, yes. And they were coming across to the border.
And some of them were war refugees, probably.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What year would this have been?
44.
So the war was pretty much winding down then, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Any war, the war started pretty another year ago.
Yeah.
But it looked like...
1944.
Okay, yeah. But it looked like... Were people getting the sense that it...
Well, I don't know.
They were still fighting in Europe.
And it was terrible in the
Pacific, you know, terrible. Going island hopping. And there wasn't even the Battle of the Bulge yet. Mm-hmm. This is September of 1944.
Okay.
And the Bulge was December of 44. The war in Europe ended in May of 45.
Right.
And the VEIJ date was August of 45. So it was pretty near a year ago.
And they didn't know that it was just a year ago.
No, oh, no. No way.
It was still like it could be a long time.
Oh, yeah.
By that time, had you started getting information about some of your friends that had been in the war?
When I first came down, almost every letter I got was, you know, somebody else had been killed. And, you know, some of my friends went over in 39.
See, they went in 39, and the first group went into to Sicily in July of 43.
This is Canadians?
That's the Canadians.
But didn't some of the Canadians also go into Africa before that? They went into Africa before that, didn't they?
But they were at the YIP, which I think was in 42.
Right.
And they were just
slaughtered,
massacred. They were all Canadian troops. Right?
They weren't well outfitted, or they just overpowered?
They thought that it was going to be an invasion, you know, they were going to take these German guys.
And they were all set up for them when they got there.
And they didn't have the experience.
And the Germans were all dug in, waiting for them.
But they said that they gained an awful lot, which helped on D-Day later on. But then a lot of the Canadian boys, they weren't even on the continent at the time that the Germans went into France in 1940. They were still in England. And then they sent the first group into Dieppe, where they were slaughtered. And then the next group went to Sicily and Italy, and they went all the way up the boot. And then, of course, there were an awful lot went in on D-Day, the Canadians. And I guess it was on D-Day that maybe, what was his name, the twin got killed.
Yeah, the Burka.
She knew twins, they were killed.
One of the boys I had gone with 2 years in high school, he was, you know, one of my best friends, and his twin brother and he went over at the same time. And Maury was in the hospital. He had been wounded. And Ronnie was in an ambulance going to the hospital, and it was blown up.
Whoa.
They were both killed.
So he and the one who was in the hospital ended up dying, and the other one...
Yeah, well, they bombed the hospital.
They bombed the
ambulances that they were going, you know. They weren't, if there was a Red Cross on the ambulances, this was the rules of the war. They weren't supposed to, but they did. I mean, they didn't play according to the rules. Both sides did it. In other words, they didn't play the rules.
That seems to be coming out more and more, that both sides...
Oh,
especially,
I'm just reading a couple of books on it.
And the Asia thing seems to have been really incredible.
Just, you can say what you want about the Germans and the Russians, but the Americans are just as bad, you know. And yet, some of them were great. Some of the Germans were great. Some of the Americans were great. They tell a story about one group of Americans... in a Red Cross for the wounded, got lost. And he ended up in the German section. And the Germans saw the Red Cross there, and they told him to get in there, get back, and go this way, and that way they got out. So about an hour later, another Red Cross comes up, and all they did was they stopped, and they put out a big bundle of stuff, you know, corrugated boxes, and they waved and they walked away. And the Germans didn't know what the hell it was, you know. They thought maybe it's a bomb or something, but they took a chance. Cigarettes, you know.
Just to thank them.
Yeah. I had a friend of mine up in Moose Jaw, Al Wilson. He was a lieutenant colonel of the artillery, Canadian. And he was telling me towards the end of the war, they were picking up so many Germans, they didn't know where to put them, you know. They had no place to put them. So he and another guy, another artillery man, driving along in a Jeep, and they saw a lone German soldier walking along, the lieutenant, young lieutenant, and they told him to get in. They got in there, and they tried to drop him off at some prison camps, and the guys would say, "Nah, we can't take him. Geez, we got too many now. Get out of here." So they'd say, well, what are we going to do? We'll try another one. So finally, one guy sort of reached the end of his rope, and he said, listen, I'm going to kill this son of a gun. And Wilson said to him, well, wait a second. He said, let's get something straight. He said, I think that I've killed thousands, maybe, of Germans with my artillery. He said, but I've never been guilty of murder. Never. And he said, I'm not going to have anyone murdered in my presence. We're going to get this guy into a camp. So finally, he went up to the next camp, and he told the guy, he says, listen, my partner here is going nuts. He wants to kill this guy. He says, I don't want to be a part of murder. So the guy says, all right, come on, give him to me. And with that, the guy turned around and picked up a link, and she said, thank you, Mr. Thank you, Colonel. I appreciate you. You saved my life. In English.
He could speak English all the time.
All the while they're talking about, they're putting a gun, you know, in his brain. He's just sitting there. Ducks ain't a word. But, I mean, this has happened time after time. They tell of guys whose brothers were killed, and a young guy, maybe 18 or 19, he'd see Germans, you know, prisoners of war, and he'd just go up and boom, boom, and that was it. Eddie O'Connor tells a story about in Sicily. He and another guy were delegated to bring a group of prisoners back, and they're walking along, it's a hot day in Sicily, you know, and this guy takes his machine gun, brrr, and knocks them all out. It says, you'll never have another day of good luck. Never, never, never. The guy got killed within moments, you know. So, you can say what you want. The Japs certainly were savage, but they say some of the Marines were just as savage. Taking their skulls and home, you know, with your for souvenirs and all that sort of stuff. Man's inhumanity to man.
Horrible. Horrible, horrible times.
Stan Gentleborough tells a story about after the war. He was in the Canadian forces that went up the boot on the east side of Italy. So he and his wife were visiting Italy, and they came to the area where his outfit had been stationed and engaged a lot of tough going, you know. So they were in a hotel. The area was part of a hotel grounds, and he's supposed to have been a member or registered at the hotel. But they weren't registered, so he went right through and he sat down there and he just looked.
Sitting on a chair in the lawn.
A chair in the lawn. And with that, German woman and a French woman come up. And the German was very impressed.
This is in the last few years.
Yeah, 12 years ago.
And she said, are you registered at the hotel? He said, no. And the French woman said, well, you should be registered after all if you want to sit here, you know. Stan says, listen, let me tell you, during the war, I and my buddies came here and we fought our way. And he said, let me tell you something. And he turned to the French woman. He said, you know something? If it hadn't been for me and my buddies who sacrificed their life, you would be taking orders from this woman. And they both walked away. Both walked away. So they
a lot of memories.
Oh, yeah. I think of Uncle Tom, you know, when you he tells a story about they were in Norfolk, Virginia. This is after the Atlanta has been sunk, and he's amongst the survivors group, and he's requested duty on another light cruiser. So he's going back on the Mobile, the USS Mobile. He's going back. But they're getting ready back in Norfolk, Virginia. So they're sitting around a bar and a grill one night, and there's an English sailor with them, and they're chatting away there and so forth and so on, having a few beers. And with that, the Englishman says, I propose a toast to the king. And the American says a very vulgar word, but he says, the hell with the king. So the Englishman looks up and he says, well, if that's the way you feel, the hell with Bibe Ruth. And Howie Thompson tells the story. He reported one Sunday morning to sick bay. He's the doctor on the destroyer. And this chief petty officer comes in and his face is a mess. Howie says, my God, chief, what the hell happened to you? He says, well, I tell you, doc, he says, last night, he said, I know we're going to the South Pacific. He said, we could get knocked off and that'd be the end of us. He said, so I figured I'd have a pretty good time the last night in Boston. So he said, I went and had a few dances. And he said, I'm coming back to the ship when I pants another dance hall. And he said, all of a sudden, I decided to have a dance. So I said, I went to a dance and so forth. And they stopped the music and they were saying, we will now play God Save the King. And he said, I said, he better save this son of a bitch. The British Navy never will. He says, that's all I remember.
Well,
you got enough for tonight?
We covered quite a bit. We covered some of your school life. We covered the beginning working life. And we covered what it was like coming down across and some of your expectations. And I think probably in the next time we'd cover more what it was like raising the family. Maybe if you think about what it was like as a Canadian, what it was like going to work for one of the American firms here, the fact it probably helped you, the experience you had with the Americans already working with them. Do you think there was any surprises, many surprises?
Not really.
Well, now you're missing out one thing, which I think is quite important. The wedding.
Well, that
we'll cover that too.
We do have a couple of minutes here on this film. Do you want to talk about what the wedding was like for you?
Well, I just brought me back a memory of me getting the job at Look Magazine. I had answered different ads, and your father had already made up his mind that I was not going to work on Saturday. So I had an opportunity to take a job on Fifth Avenue at Mary Lewis's as an assistant accountant. And I'd have to work Saturday. So I said, forget that. Can't take that job. And there was one other down in Wall Street. Yeah. I forget what it was. And I'd have to work every other Saturday or something. No, I couldn't take that job. So then I went to Look Magazine.
Because he was off on the weekend. He wanted to be home.
Right. So there were six other women. Wasn't I sent by an agency?
Yeah.
You had to pay a certain amount to the agency. But anyway, I went in and I had the interview, and there were six other girls. They told me there were six other applicants for the job. But, you know, to wait. So I waited, and I guess about an hour later, somebody came out and told me I had the job. And then Marvin Watmore, the
general manager.
He was the manager of Look or whatever he was. He was head of it anyway. He told me it was because he had heard how hardworking Canadians were, and he was impressed with my background. And that's how I got the job as the assistant to the bookkeeper. It's so funny. I can't remember her last name. I can remember her so clearly.
Selective memory.
Yeah.
Funny. And then all of a sudden, 3 weeks from now, it'll pop in.
That happened to me today. I wanted to send a get well card to one of my friends who we've known for a long time. And Irene came by, told us how bad Kathy was. And I said, dear father, what's Kathy and Tom's last name? He couldn't remember. I couldn't remember.
Who was that?
Kathy and Tom. Remember, last name? And I said, well, I can't look it up in the Rolltex file because I don't want to know her last name. So I got the card already and everything. All of a sudden,
It snapped in.
What was the name again?
Robinson.
Robinson, yeah.
And I don't know how I'd forget that.
Yeah,
because
Mrs.
of
Robinson.
The song. Right.
Do you want to say a little about your wedding?
Not really.
Okay, so maybe
we'll
that's enough
another
for.
Time.
We'll
save that for the next one.
Okay. How's the process so far?
Good. It's you. It's up to you. Mm-hmm. How it is.
No, but I mean, it seems to be flowing and.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Me was how interested she was in what went on in the farm. And I remember one time going up to Old Sturbridge in Vermont, and they had a lot of equipment that they used on the farms, you know, back years ago. And your mother knew everything what it was, everything. And the same thing, we were up at Edmonton. At Fort Saskatchewan. They had the same setup. And did you tell them about Pete? Yeah, she knew all about it, all the equipment.
Remember, I told him that he thought I lived in two centuries?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I have now.
Yeah.
That's right. We both
so have I, though. Huh? So have I, though.
Right.
Okay, we'll save some for next time.